From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, novelist Amy Tan, the author of The Joy Luck Club, has a new novel, The Hundred Secret Senses, about a Chinese girl who has yin eyes, the ability to see ghosts. Her American-born sister is a skeptic. We'll talk with Tan about how she went from doubting to believing in spirits. Also, the actor who independent filmmakers turn to, Eric Stoltz. He's been featured in Pulp Fiction, Killing Zoe, Naked in New York, and the new film Kicking and Screaming. Rock critic Ken Tucker reviews Melancholy and the Infinite Sadness by Smashing Pumpkins. And Maureen Corrigan reviews The Missionary Position, Mother Teresa in Theory and Practice by Christopher Hitchens. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Craig Windham. A judge in Tennessee has approved a class action settlement that requires two corporations to spend nearly $1 billion to repair leak damage caused by a type of plastic pipe installed in millions of homes in the U.S. Polybutylene piping is flexible and gray in color. It has been found to deteriorate over time or loosen at its fittings. The pipe is made from a resin manufactured by Shell Oil Company. The fittings were made by Hirst Celanese. Both companies have denied the pipes are faulty, but a spokeswoman for Shell applauded the final ruling. Once the judge's decision has been recorded, homeowners can make claims for leak damage. The police minister of Israel charges that Yitzhak Rabin's assassination was part of a carefully planned right-wing conspiracy to kill several Israeli public officials. More from the BBC's Lise Doucette in Jerusalem.
The police minister, Moshe Shahal, didn't mince his words. He told journalists here it would be impossible to assassinate the prime minister without an infrastructure supplied by other people. Mr. Shahal didn't accuse any group outright. The investigation and court proceedings are still underway. But he said police believe Yitzhak Rabin's murder was linked to a group of people who planned and arranged it. We believe, he said, that they established a form of organization to assassinate the prime minister and other political personalities based on their ideology to try to prevent the peace process.
The BBC's Lise Doucette in Jerusalem. Police have now arrested a total of 5 people suspected to have direct links to the assassination. The White House is stepping up pressure in its showdown with GOP congressional leaders over a stopgap spending bill to keep the government running while the budget debate continues. UPI's Bill Small reports.
Press Secretary Mike McCurry says the White House sees no chance of avoiding a government shutdown next Tuesday morning. McCurry told reporters that's because there's virtually no possibility that the Republican-controlled Congress can produce a stopgap funding bill that's acceptable to the president by this coming Monday night. And so he says Mr. Clinton's cabinet is meeting this afternoon to discuss issues of the budget and the debt ceiling and to review, in McCurry's words, plans for the orderly shutdown of the government on Tuesday morning. McCurry is quick to say his prediction for next week does not include the U.S. defaulting on its obligations, though he says that's becoming increasingly likely. Bill Small at the White House.
GOP congressional leaders say they will not back down and alter their stopgap spending bill to Mr. Clinton's specifications. A Jordanian airliner made an emergency landing at the Reykjavik airport in Iceland today after the airline received a bomb threat. The flight was en route from Amsterdam to Chicago. On Wall Street at this hour, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is up about a point at 4853.75 in heavy trading. And over-the-counter trading, the Nasdaq Composite is up over 12 points. This is NPR News. 2 House Republicans are calling for the resignation of Energy Secretary Hazel O'Leary. The Wall Street Journal reports that O'Leary paid over $40,000 in federal money to hire an investigative firm to monitor and rank journalists to cover her department. White House Chief of Staff Leon Panetta has asked O'Leary for a complete accounting, preferably by day's end. Indonesian authorities have moved to prevent a commemoration in East Timor of the 1991 massacre by Indonesian troops of dozens of unarmed protesters. They have deported 7 foreign human rights activists from East Timor and barred another 8. NPR's Mary Kay Magstad reports.
Especially at a time when East Timorese are becoming more and more vocal in their discontent over Indonesian rule, Indonesian authorities are trying to prevent incidents that could draw further international media attention. So yesterday, they expelled seven prominent foreigners from East Timor and stopped another eight en route, including the brother of an Australian journalist who was killed in East Timor during Indonesia's forced annexation of it 20 years ago. The group was to commemorate the 91 massacre in the Santa Cruz Cemetery. International human rights groups say as many as 200,000 East Timorese, a third of the population, has been killed by Indonesian troops since the annexation, which the United Nations has never recognized. I'm Mary Kay Magstad reporting.
Former Defense Secretary Robert McNamara met his one-time Vietnam War nemesis, General Nguyen Giap, today in Hanoi and asked him what really happened in August of 1964 in the Tonkin Gulf. At the time, the U.S. Navy said the North Vietnamese had attacked U.S. vessels, and that report plunged the U.S. deeper into the war. Giap, who was the chief strategist for communist forces, insists, though, that there was no attack. He says the U.S. fear that all of Southeast Asia might fall to communism was nothing more than an illusion. I'm Craig Windham, National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Amy Tan, is the author of the best-selling novel The Joy Luck Club, which was adapted into the film of the same name. The book contrasted the lives of immigrant Chinese women and their American-born daughters. Tan is the American-born daughter of Chinese immigrants. Her new novel, The Hundred Secret Senses, continues to explore the differences between Chinese and American culture. The main character, Olivia, is the daughter of an American mother and Chinese father. When Olivia is a girl, her older half-sister from China, Quan, comes to live with her. Quan claims to have what she calls yin eyes, the ability to see the ghosts of the dead. She talks to them, too. Olivia is supposed to keep this a secret, but instead she tells her American mother. Her mother sends Quan to a mental hospital where she's given electroshock therapy. This reading is from the point of view of Olivia, the American-born daughter.
For most of my childhood, I had a struggle not to see the world the way Quan described it, like her talk about ghosts. After she had the shock treatments, I told her she had to pretend she didn't see ghosts, otherwise the doctors wouldn't let her out of the hospital. "Ah, keep secret," she said, nodding. "Just you me know." When she came home, I then had to pretend the ghosts were there as part of our secret of pretending they weren't. I tried so hard to hold these two contradictory views that soon I started to see what I wasn't supposed to. How could I not? Most kids, without sisters like Quan, imagine that ghosts are lurking beneath their beds, ready to grab their feet. Quan's ghosts, on the other hand, sat on the bed, propped against her headboard. I saw them. I'm not talking about filmy white sheets that howled, "Ooh." Her ghosts weren't invisible like the affable TV apparitions in Topper who moved pens and cups through the air. Her ghosts looked alive. They chatted about the good old days. They worried and complained. I even saw one scratching our dog's neck, and Captain thumped his leg and wagged his tail. Apart from Quan, I never told anyone what I saw. I thought I'd be sent to the hospital for shock treatments. What I saw seemed so real. Not at all like dreaming. It was as though someone else's feelings had escaped, and my eyes had become the movie projector, beaming them into life.
Did ghosts figure into your childhood when you were growing up?
They did. My mother has always believed that I had the ability to see ghosts. There was a time, in fact, when I was three, and I came down the stairs and I told my mother I couldn't go to the bathroom, and I think most mothers would say, "Oh, let me take you up there, turn on the light, see there's no ghosts." But my mother asked me where they were, and she said later on that because she had never taught me this word ghost, that it was true that I had seen a ghost. To this day, she thinks that many of my stories come to me through my grandmother, and that, in effect, what I do is use my keyboard on the computer, sort of like a high-tech Ouija board.
To channel the ghosts.
Yes, right, to channel these stories. I didn't know that she had a belief in ghosts until after my father and brother became ill with brain tumors. My father was a Baptist minister, and any talk about ghosts were confined to the Holy Ghost. And when they became ill, my mother suddenly unleashed all these phantoms from her past, prayers to ancestors, believing that a door slam was signaling the arrival of her my grandmother, her mother, who died when she was a young girl. She also tried to get me to do the Ouija board and contact my father and brother because she thought she didn't have this skill, but I did. And it made me think that she had gone crazy, especially after they died. She would ask very poignant things. How are you? Do you get enough to eat? I miss you. But then she was also very practical, and she'd ask things like, what stock should I invest in? Should I sell the house for a certain price? And well, I can assure you, you know, that if there are such things as ghosts, my feeling is that they're just as disinterested in those matters of financial investing as I am. I used to scoot the little Ouija pointer to goodbye whenever I had to get to those, you know, find those answers.
Well, how did you feel as this child using the Ouija board to contact the spirits of your brother and father? Because your mother believed in it. Did you believe in it?
I didn't believe in it, but I had a fear that possibly it was true. I had these two contradictory views in my mind, and it was hard to reconcile because I often had experiences that I couldn't explain. To this day, I do. Like the character Olivia, who narrates the story in The 100 Secret Senses, I was a skeptic, in part because, you know, I thought an educated person shouldn't believe in such things. But also I had suffered a lot of disappointments and loss in life, the deaths of my father and brother and friends. And I came to believe that if you doubted such things, then you wouldn't be disappointed if you found out later it wasn't true. But to this day, when things happen, I try to find explanations for them.
What kind of things happen?
Well, on the physical realm, the things that you can sense with your ordinary five senses, you know, door slams, footsteps running up and down, crashing sounds, what sounds like somebody conducting Lambada lessons upstairs, whistling the tune to Jeopardy.
Wait a minute.
I know. Ghosts with a sense of humor. The TV turning on by itself and adjusting channels and volume. The telephone disconnecting only when I talk to my mother. The paint colors changing, but only when interior decorators come in. What I've also found, quite to my amusement, the tape recorder stopping about half the time when reporters come to interview me. It happened yesterday, actually, with the AP reporter.
Jeez,
I know things. I know names of people I could not possibly know. I had a friend, for example, who was murdered, and I knew the names of the killers before they were ever arrested. And it was a random robbery. Nobody that either I knew or my friend who was murdered knew. And sure enough, 4 days later, two men were arrested and their names were the ones that I had in my head. I have prophetic dreams. I have coincidences that are too many and too bizarre to simply chalk up to randomness or good luck. And I certainly think that many of the things that have happened to me as a writer, you can call either extraordinarily unusual amounts of good luck, or I have had a lot of help in guiding me to the right people.
Now, have you ever questioned your sanity?
Yes, I have. You know, I've thought that perhaps I am psychotic, and you know, oftentimes on those tests that they give on the personality tests and things, writers do come off as in a borderline psychotic. You know, whatever it is, it's enabled me to be a writer and to have a wonderful, amazing life.
You know what I'm thinking? Like when your mother thought about spirits or ghosts, there was a whole system for her to fit that into, the system of traditional Chinese culture.
Yes.
But you're only semi-attached to that in a way, being American-born. You know, it's not as kind of a part of you as it is. It's not as much a part of you as it is of your mother. So I'm wondering, do you feel like you have these visions and so on, but you don't have a system to fit them into?
I don't, and I don't want a system. And in part, it was my religious upbringing that made me very skeptical of being handed any system. I'd rather find my own. I'd rather ask the questions and find the answers and come up with what makes sense to me based on what's important to me in life. And I realized in the writing of the book that that's exactly what it is. We choose to believe things based on what we hope, what's important to us in life now.
My guest is Amy Tan. She's the author of The Joy Luck Club, The Kitchen God's Wife, and a new novel called The 100 Secret Senses. This is Fresh Air. Back with Amy Tan. She's written a new novel called The 100 Secret Senses. Now, I know before you started writing fiction, you were doing corporate writing. I guess newsletters, what, speeches for executives, that kind of stuff?
Speeches, brochures, pep talks to employees to work harder for the same amount of money. Fiction, you know, fiction. Yes.
And I've read that you actually went for counseling at one point because you were working so hard. Friends were telling you were a workaholic and you needed help.
I was working 90 billable hours a week.
Was that for money, or were there things that you were trying to keep at bay by thinking about your work all the time instead of the other things that you could be thinking about?
I think it was more about how we determine happiness. I bought into the notion that happiness came through success, and success was measured by money. And I never felt satisfied. So I thought, well, maybe I'm not working hard enough. Maybe I need to earn more money. And I kept doing more and more and more. And the more I worked, the less happy I, you know, was. And I finally realized that I had to just redefine what I meant by happiness and success and all of that. So I went to a psychiatrist. Unfortunately, the psychiatrist was not very attentive. He fell asleep during three sessions. And I decided I'd either get a severe case of low self-esteem or I should do my own kind of therapy. And that's when I decided that I would take jazz piano, improvisational jazz piano, and start reading fiction again and writing fiction, but do these things only for myself. I had no intention of playing jazz piano in front of people, nor did I want to necessarily show my work or have my work published.
When you write now, do you pace yourself well, or is there still an element of working too hard like you did when you were doing the business writing?
I pace myself in part because I know I can't force some things out. Sometimes I need to go and be part of life because that's where my material comes from. I do go through spurts where I'll work all day long, 10 hours, 12 hours, nonstop, and that's when the writing is the best because I'm fully focused, I'm concentrating, I'm in that world. During the last part of writing this new book, I worked around the clock. I worked for 24 hours once, nonstop. And I was amazed to look behind me. I had enclosed myself in a closet, literally a closet. And when I opened the doors to the closet, I was amazed to find the sun had come up after what I thought was only 20 minutes of, you know, after I'd gone in there at 6 p.m. And what I thought was 20 minutes.
Well, I know when you were younger, I guess it's when you were in your late teens, early 20s, you changed the course, the direction of your life. Your mother, I think, thought you should be a doctor, and you were pre-med in school. You left where you were living to live with your boyfriend. You changed your major from pre-med to English, and I believe you and your mother didn't speak for several months after that.
Yeah.
At that point in your life, did you have a choice to make about whether you were going to figure out who you were supposed to be becoming or whether you were going to follow the direction that your mother thought you should and become the person that she wanted you to be? Was that a big crisis for you, deciding which direction to go in?
At the time, I didn't think that I needed to decide who I was going to be. It was a very temporal thing. It was had mostly to do with what I wanted now, at that moment, without any regard to future. I did not really think about my meaning in life, what was important for the duration of my life until my 20s, when I was in a doctoral program in linguistics at Berkeley. I suppose I didn't think about this because I always felt that I might die soon anyway, since all this stuff had happened in our family. But when I was in my 20s, this very close friend of ours was murdered, and he had, was somebody who was very directed, knew he wanted to develop equipment for disabled people. And I thought, here I am wanting to be Ms. Academic, you know, and write theories that nobody's going to read simply to satisfy my own ego. And what am I doing in this world, and why isn't he in this world? So I quit my program, and I went to work with disabled children for the next 5 years.
Hmm. When your father and brother died, did you and your mother find really different explanations for it?
Yes. My mother believed that my father and brother died for a reason that could be found, for many reasons that could be found. She thought that there was something in the house that caused us to have bad harmony. My mother also felt that there might have been something environmental that caused my brother and father to have the same kind of cancer.
Mm-hmm.
I've become involved since then as an adult with the Brain Tumor Research Foundation, and so far there's nothing that they can find that is either environmentally or genetically linked. And yet, adding to all of this, my mother has a benign brain tumor. So
no.
That's three people in our family who have brain tumors. She's fine. I mean, she's healthy, and she's alive and well, thankfully. My mother had other reasons having to do with karmic debt, that perhaps someone in our family did something in a past life, and now we were suffering from this. I, on the other hand, attributed all of this to a fluke. I didn't want to believe in anything, because any of these explanations that my mother was looking for carried bad, potentially bad consequences for me. If it was environmental or genetic, then maybe I would get a brain tumor. If it was karmic debt, then I was destined, you know, to have something terrible happen to me. If the house was in bad alignment, you know, maybe we would, all of us would always be in bad alignment. I only saw the negative, the fear of reasons. I preferred to ignore at that age any possible explanation.
What about now? What do you turn to explain now three brain tumors in your family? Are you looking to science or to the spirit world? Or?
Well, I don't think that these... I am looking to science, as I mentioned, because I have been part of brain tumor research. But I don't know if I'm going to find it or whether it's necessary to find it. I leave that as an open area to question. I also know that what I believe in is the power of love and the necessity of grief for learning what's important in my life.
Mm-hmm.
The other night, I woke up, I had a dream about my father, and I was in public, and suddenly, in this dream, I could not stop crying. And I put my hands to my face, and all these tears were pouring out, so many tears that I, a pool of water was in my hands. And I couldn't stop. You know, I was embarrassed at first because I was in public and I couldn't stop this. But then I realized, no, this is good. I'm so glad that even after all these years, I can still grieve this much for my father.
Yeah. Still feel that much.
Yeah. Yeah.
I have one last question for you. You know, since you seem to have all this connection to a spirit world, do you worry that it's going to turn against you sometime, that the spirits can become malevolent and hurt you? You know, so far what you've described is kind of like mischievous, and it helps you find information, helps you write your books.
No, I've never had an experience that seems at all like that. The, like the tape recorder going off the other day, talking to the interviewer, I said, can't you hear them laughing? They, it's a way of saying hello. All the things that I've had happen to me, whether these are true or whether it's my system of belief that I have, it's there always for the good, always for knowledge, for the purpose of understanding my connection to the world. Not afraid at all. I'm delighted when things happen. And then sometimes annoyed when I'm in the middle of writing and I hear the door slam and footsteps run up and then crashing going on upstairs, and I think my husband has come home, and I break from my work and go upstairs and nobody's there. You know, then I say, come on, guys, you know, I really have to get back to work. I take it as hello, as a very warm greeting.
Amy Tan, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Amy Tan's new novel is called The 100 Secret Senses. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations, and by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, actor Eric Stoltz, co-star of Pulp Fiction, Little Women, and Kicking and Screaming. Rock critic Ken Tucker reviews the new album by Smashing Pumpkins, and Maureen Corrigan reviews The Missionary Position, Christopher Hitchens' controversial book about Mother Teresa. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Since their debut in 1990, the Chicago quartet Smashing Pumpkins has managed to become one of the best-selling acts in alternative rock. Now the Pumpkins have released Melancholy and the Infinite Sadness, a 28-song collection that runs more than 2 hours and which debuted at number one on the Billboard album chart. This weekend, Smashing Pumpkins will be the musical guest on Saturday Night Live. Rock critic Ken Tucker has a review.
You'd be hard-pressed to find a bigger brat in rock and roll than Billy Corgan, the 28-year-old leader of Smashing Pumpkins. You'd also be hard-pressed to find any rocker more ambitious and imaginative. You have to take Corgan's smirky self-absorption along with his fertile creativity. With Melancholy and the Infinite Sadness, he may have given us an album title as dumb and pretentious as anything Pink Floyd or Emerson, Lake & Palmer ever came up with, but he's also given us an album tighter and more progressive than anything those progressive rockers ever came up with. Smashing Pumpkins is probably the most popular alternative rock band since Nirvana. Their second album, Siamese Dream, sold more than 3 million copies on the strength of its swirling psychedelic rhythms and the cutting wail of Corgan. But if Corgan's gifts for catchy melodies and burly guitar playing are Smashing Pumpkins' biggest attractions, he also embodies the band's worst flaws, too. In a recent interview with Rolling Stone, Corgan said he still spends, quote, a lot of time thinking about what a 15-year-old must be thinking right now, because that's the predominant audience that you're going to be relating to, and there are still a lot of issues from that time in my life that are unresolved. Unquote. Well, I'd say to Corgan that the rock audience he's appealing to includes millions of listeners a lot older than 15, and we're already kind of sick of Smashing Pumpkins' sentiments like, I'm in love with my sadness, and love is suicide, and despite all my rage, I'm still just a rat in a cage. Ah, quit therapy, Billy. Life is tough. Act your age.
Speak to me in a language I can hear. He will be before I have to go. Deep in thought, I forgive everyone. As the clouded streets greet me. Tomorrow's just an excuse away. So I pull my collar up and face the cold on my own.
Billy Corgan is an interesting, original composer. Few of his songs follow the conventional verse-chorus-verse structure of rock and roll, and his punk rock roots haven't kept him from being open to influences as diverse as Black Sabbath and Nick Drake. As long as I don't listen to all of its drivelly lyrics, I like this big, sprawling collection, and it has the opposite effect than Billy Corgan probably intended. Melancholy and the Infinite Sadness makes me happy.
Ken Tucker is critic at large for Entertainment Weekly. He reviewed Melancholy and the Infinite Sadness, the new album from Smashing Pumpkins.
We only come out at night. We only come out at night. The days are much too bright. We only come out at night. And once again,
Coming up, an interview with actor Eric Stoltz. This is Fresh Air. Eric Stoltz seems to have two parallel acting careers, one in Hollywood and the other in independent cinema. He first became well-known through his role in the 1985 film Mask as a teenager with a deforming bone disease. More recently, he co-starred in Rob Roy as Rob Roy's trusted friend and in Little Women as Laurie's tutor. He played a heroin dealer in Pulp Fiction, directed by Quentin Tarantino, the king of independent filmmakers, and starred in the independent films Killing Zoe, Naked in New York, and Bodies Rest in Motion. Film critic Jay Hoberman dubbed Stoltz the grand old man of ambitious youth comedies. Stoltz stars in the new film Kicking and Screaming, written and directed by 25-year-old Noah Baumbach. The story is about that period of limbo between college graduation and so-called real life. Stoltz plays a 28-year-old who can't seem to stop being a student. Here he is, approached by a woman at a party.
I am so glad to find an actual adult at one of these parties. It's really just a bunch of freaked out kids, huh?
Yeah.
I'm Jocelyn.
Jocelyn? What an interesting name. I'm Chet.
Chet?
Hello.
So what do you do?
I'm a philosophy German major.
Philosophy German? Mm-hmm. I don't get it. You're not still a student, are you?
Oh, yeah. Well, technically, at least until I complete my thesis, which is becoming more and more overwhelming each year. This third tome has become quite a battle, which is odd because the second book came quite effortlessly.
How many years have you been here?
Oh, God, it'll be 10 come January. But I skipped a semester my sophomore year.
Eric Stoltz, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you. It's nice to be here.
Now, how did you choose Kicking and Screaming?
About 3 years ago, I did a film with Mary Louise Parker called Naked in New York.
Yes, I like that film.
Thank you. She gave me this script called Fifth Year by Noah Baumbach and said, it's an amazing script. We have to do it. Your friend is producing it, Joel Castleberg. I read the script, and I was 10 years too old for any role in it. I called Mary Louise. I said, I can't do this. I'm 33 years old. I can't be in this film. Cut to 2 years later, Noah's doing the film. And I meet him, and I say, you know, I'll do a cameo or something in your film, but I'm really too old to do a role in it. And he said, fine, and I was set to do the video dealer. I go off to Scotland to do Rob Roy, and within 24 hours, I get a furious flurry of faxes from Joel Castleberg and Noah, the director, saying their lead actor had pulled out of the film to do some action film. They were going to lose the financing unless they got a name within 24 hours. Would I do it? And I faxed him back and said, well, I'd love to help you out, but there's no role for me. I'm old. I'm in my 30s. I can't play a collegiate. And Noah said, well, we'll write something for you. We'll come up with a character, a bartender or something. We'll create something on the set. And that really is an opportunity you rarely get in a feature film, to improvise and create something as you're making the film. So I agreed.
So you're the student who's been a student on the college campus for about 10 years. So you helped make up the role as you went along?
Yes. I like to look at it as the wizened bartender, moral conscious Jiminy Cricket centered true adult perpetual student role.
Which is interesting for you, since I think you only spent like 2 years in college, so your background doesn't quite parallel. Yes, parallel the characters.
Well, I personally hated college, which is odd because I come from a family, a long line of educators in my family. It was only after I hit my mid-20s and I'd really traveled around the world that I felt a need to continue my education. I would love to go back to college at this point, but it's probably not going to happen.
Now, have you done a lot of films where the director was making their first movie?
I've done, it feels like, thousands of films with first-time directors. I tell you, I feel like the old whore that in a farming community that fathers bring their sons to for the first time. Get it over with Stoltz. He's painless and only costs $5.
That's really funny. Yeah. So do you end up advising the young filmmakers a lot, or just like laying back and letting them do their thing?
Well, every filmmaker is different. If they ask me for my advice, I'm more than happy to pipe in.
Mm-hmm.
And occasionally, if things are going dreadfully wrong, I'll say, listen, why don't we just, you know, put the camera here and do this? But generally, I tend to lay back and watch them. It's a lot of fun working with first-time directors. They're generally extremely passionate, almost annoyingly so.
No, but say a first-time director is directing you to do something that you're unsure is really going to work.
Mm-hmm.
Will you be more likely to say the first-time director than the old experienced director, I don't think this is going to work?
No. What I try and do is I try and make it work. I do it a few times,
mm-hmm.
and say, is this the direction you want? And if it's clear that it's not working, then I'll say, why don't we try something else? And I'll come up with a few different ideas. I try not to be judgmental about whether or not it'll work before we've actually tried it. Because more often than not, I'm wrong, or my approach is not right.
Eric Stoltz is my guest, and he's in the new film Kicking and Screaming. Now, you were in Pulp Fiction, which it seems to me so many people are trying to make in their own way right now. It's like a touchstone for every young filmmaker. Mm. Now, how did you get the part in Pulp Fiction?
I'd known Quentin Tarantino for a while. We were both at the Sundance Film Festival in 91 or 92. He was with Reservoir Dogs and I was with The Water Dance.
Oh.
And we were sort of the competition. And we met each other and really hit it off. And then I did a film that he produced called Killing Zoe. And then he acted in a film that I produced called Sleep With Me. And then he called me in to... Actually, he called me in to have dinner and hang out and talk about Pulp Fiction. That's really what an audition entailed for Quentin.
Now, did he have you in mind for the role that you ended up playing, or was he just feeling you out for other possibilities too?
I don't really remember that well. I think it was one of the two robed roles, as we call it. he ended up playing the other robed role, and I like to think that my robe was much more interesting color than his.
Right, these are the two suburban guys in their bathrobes.
Right.
Yeah, it's an interesting character you play because you're living in this like suburban house with a big lawn
and Christmas lights.
Yeah, and you're a heroin dealer.
Well, I think a lot of drug dealers are very middle class, upstanding citizens.
In the film, you're married to a woman played by Rosanna Arquette, and she has like everything pierced. You know, her nose, her ears, her private parts, and so she's really on the edge. And you're a heroin dealer, and you just kind of like squabble all the time, like the stereotype of a certain kind of middle class suburban couple, in spite of all these bohemian trappings.
Yes, that's something we wanted to make sure came across, is that even though you purport to live on the edge or have a bohemian lifestyle, when it comes to relationships, you bicker like anyone else.
There's a great scene where Travolta, after he has bought heroin from your character, Uma Thurman unknowingly, thinking it's cocaine, snorts the heroin, she ODs, and he's bringing her to your house for some help, and you're telling him to go away.
Right.
And then you decide, well, you're going to give her a shot of adrenaline to the heart to help revive her, but you have to read up on how to do it because you've never done this before, and you go frantically looking for your nursing book to find it.
Hurry up, Lance, we're losing her!
I'm looking as fast as I can!
What's he looking for?
Some book.
What are you looking for?
A little black medical book.
What are you looking for?
A little black medical book. It's like a textbook they give the nurses.
I never saw no medical book.
Well, trust me, I have one.
Well, if it's so important, why didn't you keep with the shot?
I don't know. Stop bothering me.
Listen, what are you looking for? That girl's going to die in our carpet. You're never going to find anything
in
this
house. Honey, I'm going to kill you. Shut up.
Play this shit out.
Get in here.
Right?
Was this scene improvised at all?
No. Well, parts of it were improvised. Most of it we stuck to the script because it was such a fantastic script. But I think there were takes where I accidentally broke a window or I tripped or John and I dropped Uma. where we kept rolling and naturally improvised a few lines. But basically, we stuck to the script.
Now, two of your recent major motion picture type roles were in period movies, Little Women and Rob Roy.
Right, right.
And actually, I was surprised when I heard you were going to be in those films because there's something about you that reads so contemporary. And I guess particularly because you've been in a lot of roles as... You've been in a lot of roles in movies that are very much set in the moment, you know, in the now.
Right.
So how did you feel about taking period roles?
Absolutely love them.
Mm-hmm.
They're so much fun. I cannot tell you that. They're hardly ever done, for one thing. And when they're done well, like Little Women and Rob Roy, it's just a joy. It's like stepping into a history book in the costumes, in the actual locations, doing something that you know your nieces and nephews can see and you won't get in trouble for.
Unlike
Pulp Fiction or Killing Zoe, where most of my family are not allowed to go.
Right, right. You know, it's funny for an actor such as you, who is now so associated with independent pictures. You got your start in Fast Times at Ridgemont High, which was a big commercial success, big high school movie. Was this your first film?
It was indeed my very first film.
Did you think you were heading for perpetual high school roles after that?
Well, yes. Most of the 80s I spent doing quite a bit of high school roles in one way or the other. I think what I thought when we were making Fast Times was that every film would be as much fun. Literally, what you saw on the screen was 1/10 of the party that actually happened when we made that film. It was fantastic. And for a first experience, I think it really spoiled me. And sadly, not every film is as enjoyable as Fast Times was.
No, a few years later, you got a high school role that was a very different kind of role. You were the star of Mask,
right,
where you had... a disease that led to fast-growing facial bones, and you were terribly disfigured in that movie.
Craniodiaphyseal dysplasia. I'm surprised you don't remember the term.
Yes, forgive me. Well, I figured acting in that, I mean, you were really good in that. Acting in that must have been like, working with one hand tied behind your back. You had no... real face. I mean, the face wasn't yours outside of the eyes. Mm. So you couldn't use subtle facial expressions in the way that you could if you didn't have to wear all the makeup.
Yeah, it was bizarre then, but actually it led to something interesting, which made me think of the Greek plays, in that it was almost like I was wearing a mask. So what I had to do was compensate in terms of my vocal intonations or my bodily posture. And it was almost an exercise. How can I convey this emotion physically or tonally without my face? It was interesting.
When you were in Mask, now I read you actually walked around with the facial disfigurement makeup outside to see what kind of reactions you'd get.
Yes, I did.
What kind of reactions did you get? Did people react to you like you were disfigured or like you were walking around in a costume?
No, it looked actually like it was real as it could look. As real as it looked in the movie, it looked on the streets.
Uh-huh.
And people were quite cruel, actually. I'm sad to report that humanity really let me down. They would yell things out their car windows, or some people threw some things at me.
Wow.
It was horrific. It was absolutely horrifying, I must say.
You were surprised?
I was surprised and disappointed. And years later, when I did a film called The Water Dance, I did a similar thing. I stayed in a wheelchair for several months. And I got similar responses from people. People don't want to look at you. They ignore you. Or they go overboard and are fawningly servile and polite to you. Both responses are annoying, I find. It's a curious thing.
And the responses you found helped to inform your performance in both of those films?
Yes, absolutely. I don't feel a need to do that kind of research on every role, but when it's something far from my reality, I try and do as much as possible.
Now, I recently saw you on Mad About You playing Helen Hunt's ex-boyfriend.
Yes.
I don't remember seeing you on TV before, although I do believe you've done, you know, your share of, you know, guest roles.
Right.
What were you doing on Mad About You?
Well, I was in Scotland doing Rob Roy, and I got a fax from Helen, who is an old friend. We did...
You did Water Dance together.
We did Water Dance together. We also did Our Town on Broadway together.
Oh.
We go way back, Helen and I. And she sent me a fax in Scotland. Actually, that's how I maintain a lot of my relationships when I'm on location, is through faxing. It's a bit like letter writing, only quicker. And Helen sent me this fax, and in it she mentioned that there was a role coming up of an ex-boyfriend, and would I be interested? And I faxed her back, sure, if I'm in town, I'd love to do it. And that's how it happened. It was really a joy. I gotta say, it's such a lovely show.
Mm-hmm.
I had such a wonderful time. And Paul Reiser and I are really good friends now. So basically, my friends, who are now all hugely rich and successful television actors, fax me and say, hey, why don't you come on my show? And I oblige.
Eric Stoltz, he stars in the new film Kicking and Screaming. This is Fresh Air. Mother Teresa is the gold standard for human decency in our culture. In just the past few weeks alone, her name has been invoked on the TV shows NYPD Blue and Murder One, and by the redoubtable feminist Ellen Willis in The Village Voice. But journalist Christopher Hitchens has taken a dimmer view of the image of Mother Teresa. In 1994, he made a documentary about Mother Teresa that aired on British television called Hell's Angel, followed by critical pieces on her in Vanity Fair and The Nation. Book critic Maureen Corrigan says Hitchens' popularity among Mother Teresa's supporters will plummet even further with the publication of his latest salvo, a book called The Missionary Position.
One of the consequences of growing up Catholic is that you accumulate a lot of religious souvenirs that you become either too sentimental or too residually pious to throw away. In the bottom layer of my jewelry box, I've got a few holy cards, a miraculous medal, rosary beads, and a tiny padded square of cloth embossed with the picture of a haloed woman holding a crucifix. On the back are printed the words, Relic of Saint Therese. I've sometimes toyed with the idea of cutting open the square just to see what's inside. A jawbone fragment? Maybe an eyelash? But on those occasions, the word sacrilege has flashed through my brain, and I've dropped that square like a hot coal. Christopher Hitchens' just-published exposé of Mother Teresa also feels sacrilegious to me. Just the title alone, The Missionary Position, is enough to land the heretic Hitchens in the inferno, right alongside Martin Luther. But because I've long been an admirer of Hitchens' Ginzu steak knife sharp wit and devastating argumentative insights, I've fought my discomfort and went ahead and read The Missionary Position. By the end, I felt as though Hitchens had ripped open that relic square for me and exposed nothing but a tin Cracker Jack prize embedded within. The Missionary Position has the aura of an apocalyptic face-off. In one corner, there's Hitchens, the battle-scarred champion of secular humanist rationality. In the other, there's Mother Teresa, apostle to the wretched of the earth and a shoe-in for sainthood. Hitchens plunges forward with his plan to judge Mother Teresa's reputation by her actions and words, rather than her actions and words by her reputation. What emerges is a picture of an all-too-human woman who has supported the Contras in Nicaragua and associated with dictators like Baby Doc Duvalier and swindlers like Charles Keating and Robert Maxwell. Far from being an apolitical naif, Mother Teresa has exerted her influence around the world to proselytize against abortion and contraception. But, you might protest, what about her charitable good works? No straightforward stairway to heaven there either, according to Hitchens. Citing accounts by former co-workers, Hitchens claims that, despite multi-million-dollar charitable donations, Mother Teresa's hospices are deliberately under-equipped. Unlike the state-of-the-art hospitals she herself has checked into for heart trouble. The point of her missionary effort, Hitchens says, is not the relief of misery, but the promulgation of a cult based on death and suffering and subjugation. Harsh words, so it's not surprising that in a review of the missionary position in Newsweek this week, Hitchens was taken to task for not being objective. But objectivity is not Hitchens' aim. He's a polemicist in the tradition of his hero, Thomas Paine. Nor is Hitchens' primary aim here the demolition of Mother Teresa. As he's acknowledged elsewhere, she's certainly not the worst person on the face of the earth. Instead, Hitchens argues it's what Mother Teresa represents that's awful. The false consolation, the way she functions as a sop to the conscience of the wealthy, thus helping to foster the continued misery of the poor. Mother Teresa may be devout, but in Hitchens' view, she's no saint. If he has his way, the future of that particular illusion will be doomed.
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. She reviewed The Missionary Position by Christopher Hitchens. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Our engineers this week are Audrey Bentham and Al Banks. Roberta Sherrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Crown, publisher of Tom, the Unknown Tennessee Williams, a biography by Lyle Leverick. Celebrating 25 years of radio excellence, this is NPR, National Public Radio.